So I'm Rick Hansen, and it's the 31st of July, 2013. And normally, if you've heard me give talks, I'm pretty prepared. You know, I have notes, I think about what I'm going to do, at least it's in my mind. And I'm really uncharacteristically unprepared in a certain sense today. I've been reading my book all day long in a recording studio, and because it's being turned into an audiobook. And that's a very curious experience. So I thought about what to do about that. And I've been in different settings. For example, traditionally, there's a whole strand of monastic teaching where you're not supposed to prepare at all. Like, you're not supposed to. You literally are supposed to just be mellow and stand up and start talking, right? And then at the other end of the spectrum is a lot of preparation. And so I ask your forgiveness in advance a little bit about that. That said, after thinking a lot about what I could talk about, I wanted to explore the topic of peace because I personally feel very peaceful tonight, not entirely sure why. And peace is a subject in Buddhism that is very fundamental and central, and I don't think we've explored it that much in here. Recently, there's been a strong thrust, you know, from me, and the group's been very engaged with that, about what to do in practical relationship issues. You know, the last few talks I've done have had titles like Buddhist assertiveness is not an oxymoron. I think the last one I did was about Buddhist entitlement is not an oxymoron. The importance of feeling reasonably entitled in a healthy sense, you know, in interactions with other people, standing up for oneself. But today, I'm going to take a little risk and kind of go with, you know, what's there for me, which is really to explore with you the subject of peace. You may know that the Buddha said, I teach one thing, suffering and its end. So what is the end of suffering, as he described it? He said, the end of suffering is the highest happiness, which is peace. So what does he mean by that? And how does this practice relate to that? And what are some of the practical implications? That's what I would like to explore a little bit with you. So traditionally, there's a metaphor about the nature of practice. And it goes to a very deep question about what is Buddhism altogether. In this traditional metaphor, the path is overgrown. And what we do in practice is we clear away the obscurations, we clear away the impediments, we clear away the disturbances. And then eventually, as we walk down this path that we've cleared away, we eventually come to this fabulous city that's overgrown with vines. It's hidden. Nobody knows how to get to it. But once we eventually get there, there we are. The path does not create the city. The path does not create the highest happiness, which is peace. But the path gets us to it. See the distinction there? It's not a cause. The path is not a cause, but it gets us there. And that highest happiness in the Buddhist language is an immersion in unconditionality. Because whatever is conditioned is subject to disturbance and is therefore an unreliable basis for fundamental happiness. So in effect, we get to the peace that was always there, except it was hidden. It was obscured, as they say in Tibet, by various disturbances. Well, a couple key points about that. I might have four by the time I'm done with the three. You never know when you're making it up on the spot. But anyway, well, one is, to me, that's good news. It's about uncovering what's already true rather than scratching and clawing to create something. What a relief it is to have an intuition or faith, even, that deep down it's good news. The second thing is that that teaching is, for me, very consistent with the experience of myself and many people, probably everybody actually, that underneath it all, or in the cracks, as it were, of the mind, in the grout, you know, in the mosaic between the neurotic tile here and the greed there and the aversion over there and the me, myself, and I here and my cookie, my precious, whatever. In between, in the cracks, what you can kind of sense is something deeply peaceful. Awareness itself is deeply peaceful. Underneath it all, when we're not disturbed, there's something that feels very profound and tranquil and at ease. And what a relief. And the Buddha's statement, that's the highest happiness, has a ring of truth to it. So it's easy to think about this peace as some sort of metaphysical abstraction out there, or 50 lifetimes away, or 50 billion lifetimes away. But another way to relate to it is much more intimately in our own experience, where we have a sense that this peace is already within us. We're just distracted from it again and again and again. And the third takeaway from this consideration is to really investigate what is it that is disturbing us from our natural condition? What are the disturbances? Now, classically in Buddhism, the three great disturbances, the three great fuels for the fires of disturbance are greed, chasing after the pleasant, hatred, quote unquote, resisting the unpleasant, and delusion that doesn't recognize what's there, the peace that's underneath it all, when we let things fall open to it. I personally would add, based on the deeply social nature of our human species and the human brain, and something that's implicit in the Dharma, but I'd like to make it explicit, is I think another disturbance is around heartache. Loneliness, feeling abandoned, carrying into adulthood, issues from childhood, feeling ashamed of ourselves, the social emotions, envy, comparison. I was in a situation earlier today where somebody said about somebody else, "Oh, I just love that man." And then I kind of watched my mind spin for the next 10, 15 minutes, kind of quietly, more or less in the background, but definitely spinning, you know. She didn't say that about me. The comparison thing. So I want to add heartache to it. So the disturbances. Now, what makes us disturbed? We get disturbed when we feel like our needs are not met. Okay? So there's a place for doing what we can to internalize again and again the felt sense of needs being met, doing what we can out there to get our needs met, and helping ourselves recognize that our needs are being met, or that a lot of the things that we think we need, we don't actually need at all. Okay. There's a place for that. There's also a place, I think, for really honoring the animal of the body, which is scared and hungry and uneasy in its relationships, kind of as an almost default setting, because that's how Mother Nature has evolved us, so that we'll always, you know, keep our edge. So one thing we can do, too, is to address those disturbances that are grounded in a kind of delusion, because the truth is, in the moment, we're actually not threatened. In the moment, we're actually not let down. And in the moment, we're actually not being provoked or mistreated by other people. So we do that too, right? Then there's a subtler disturbance, which you may have some sense of it, especially if your mind is quiet. There's this problem in the brain. To survive, to recognize a banana, to distinguish between friend and foe, we need to stabilize things. We need to essentialize them. We need to say, this is different from that. In fact, there is a this that's stable. Or, I am thinking X rather than Y. The problem is to do that in the completely streaming, complicated network of the brain. There has to be this ongoing effort to partition dynamic streaming processes, segregate this from that, stabilize this coalition of synapses, which is decaying as it is stabilized, and also continually changing down deep in its molecular hardware. So there's this kind of tension. You can observe it in your own experience, the kind of effortful construction of the next moment of experience, trying to hold it in place, trying to stabilize, trying to make it happen. And so these are the deeper disturbances. These are the disturbances that we grapple with, right, that hide our inner peace. what to do about them. And there's a lot of Dharma about this. I think an important part of this is to really register felt needs met, to really honor the body and the animal of the body, to help it realize, you know, in the metaphor I've used, you know, the inner lizard, the inner mouse, and the inner monkey, that the lizard is safe, the mouse is fed, and the monkey is loved, right? There's a place for that, taking that in again and again and again. But there's something deeper than that, too, you might have a sense of. And so I want to talk with you a little bit about honoring peace. Peace in the mind, peace between us and other people, you know, peace in the way we relate to the world. Peace doesn't get, you know, it gets a sort of mouth service, you know, visualize world peace, right? World peace, right? But what does it really mean to orient to peace as a value? To what extent is peace a value? And if you think about an important relationship or think about engagement in life, to what extent do we actually care about the highest happiness, which is peace, right? And so I just wanted to offer two thoughts about that and then see what you think. Okay, so far you see the centrality of peace? Peace is when there isn't craving. You know, so much of Buddhism is languaged as negation, you know, not killing, not stealing, not lying, not abusing intoxicants, not abusing sexuality, not harming, not clinging, not grasping, not resisting. You know, it's described in that way. Well, what's left when all that falls open, etc.? So two things. The first is, a lot of the language of Buddhism is about entanglement. How do we tangle ourselves up? You know, I tangled myself up in that woman's comment about that other guy, right? Think about all the other ways we tangle ourselves up with other people. I'm not talking about being a doormat or being mistreated, but think about the entanglements. That's where letting go comes in. You know, you recall that in the meditation I emphasized the essence of it as basically mindfulness and letting go. I mean, that's from Ajahn Chah, the teacher in the lineage that led to Spirit Rock and IMS and kind of a major strand of Buddhism in the West. You know, he basically says, what is meditation? Knowing and letting go. You could describe knowing as mindfulness and letting go or presence and letting go, but in all cases, it's letting go. As Ajahn Chah also said, if you let go a little, you'll have a little happiness. You know, if you let go a lot, you'll have a lot of happiness. If you let go completely, you'll be completely happy. So what is that complete letting go? Right? What is that? What is that like? What is it like to sit in practice or interact with another person and utterly abandon? He uses that word too. Abandon or uproot or utterly let go. And I think a big part of that is not getting tangled up with other people and experiencing more and more deeply what's always already true. In other words, starting to have more and more access to the stillness, to that which doesn't change, to unconditionality that's always there, or to have access to, in terms of our own experience, that kind of space in the mind before the next component or content of experience is constructed, that kind of fertile noise that's between the thoughts, or just prior to something congealing into thought. It's to really honor that intuition and return to it again and again and again. You know, there's this saying, sudden awakening, or moments of awakening many times a day, right? We have this intuition, and then it's gone, and then we have it again, and then it's gone, and we start stringing those moments more and more together. So to sum up, and then I'm curious what you think about this topic, which I've never really just splashed out. I'm just going for it tonight, whatever. It's, one, it's really honoring our intuition of stillness, of tranquility. Tranquility is one of the seven factors of awakening in Buddhism. Our intuition of what's always just prior to the emergence of conditioned phenomena, or our intuition of the quiet, if you will, of awareness, which itself is not disturbed by what it represents, or the space between the thoughts, or however you put it for yourself, that stillness you feel in nature, you know, that stillness when you have an intuition of the universe as a whole, to really honor that and take our footing, find our footing there, you know, take our seat there, to create sanctuary for it in our lives, and to return to it multiple times a day. It's very important, that anchor, you know. I think the path is peace. And every time we have an intuition of peace, we're on the path, and we've cleared away the underbrush one more bit. Second thing that I'm saying to sum up is about disentangling ourselves. Disentangling ourselves from our habitual patterns, disentangling ourselves from our own ego and positions, disentangling ourselves from wrangles with other people, you know. And then the last thing that I want to say about peace is to tend to the causes we can. Peace is not about being inert or just disengaged or being pushed around. Ajahn Chah has this wonderful story, you may have heard it, where as he taught in a forest setting that was very rural, and many of the people who came to him were local farmers and so forth. He said that, you know, if you want some fruit, you can go and get a really good tree, and you can dig a really good hole, and you can plant it really well, fertilize it, and so forth. And then you can take really good care of it over a number of years, but you cannot make it give you an apple. We get tangled up in wanting results, the apples, when in fact all we can do is tend to the causes that we can while letting go at the same time of whatever may come from them. So to me, this is the art a lot in relationships, to bring it back to, you know, what we've been talking about. It's to think about three things, basically. A kind of honoring and a returning to and a gradual uncovering and a finding your, taking your stand in, your own intuition of peace, whatever that is for you. Second, disentangling from all the little knots and threads and messes with other people. And third, doing what you can and being at peace that you've done what you could to tend to the causes. What do you think? What's your own intuition of peace, or, you know, how do you think about this in relationships with other people? I can think immediately myself of entanglements with family members, other people, complications, just so needless, just so needless. Yeah, great. Emily. Oh, please pick up. Yeah, thank you, Emily. Great, that's great. Yeah.
To me, entanglements, off the top of my head, there are two causes that come up.
Yeah.
One is I want people to be different than they are.
Yeah.
And that causes great entanglements because particularly family members or people that I know, I can't accept them as they are.
Yeah.
And they've been that way for a long time. I mean, still cannot just say that's the way they are. And so that's one major cause of entanglements for me. And the other, sort of related, but it's expectations in the moment that about I want this to happen or that to happen, and they are not doing it. Those are, to me, you know, major entanglement issues.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. Yeah. I have a little question, and again, other people, what you think. If you're in a situation with someone and you can start to feel it's not quite a mess yet, right? But it could go there, or there's the beginning of a little tension or something. And a very powerful question is to stop and ask yourself, and it's something I do sometimes, hopefully more often than that even, which is ask yourself, is there already peace? Is there already some access to an ease, a peace? And then when we access it, if we take that step, when we do, just tuning in, you know, kind of quietly, a few seconds worth, not, you know, going into the middle of a home, you know, in the middle of an interaction with something, just a few seconds, so often all kinds of other complicating, entangling reactions just fall away. They're kind of undone because we're already in a state, we already have some access to, you know, or to peace.
Yeah, you said to tend to the causes. Could you elaborate a little bit more on what you mean by that? Is that what I meant?
Oh, yeah. Well, Ajahn Chah meant it's to do what you can. I think a recent version is in the book Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, Stephen Covey's distinction between the circle of concern, which is what we worry about and care about, and the circle of influence. And he said that basically you set yourself up for trouble if the two don't line up. If you think about it, where we have the circle of influence outside the circle of concern is wasted resources. And the circle of concern that's outside the circle of influence is suffering. And the sweet spot is where they intersect. As a detail, I think there's a little exception, which is where we offer compassion and kindness to beings that we can do nothing to help. And yet it's important to bear witness to their suffering and to wish them well, even though we can't do anything about it. But that is the thing we can do. I think in my own relationships, the circle of influence is to realize that most of what is producing the other person's reactions right now is completely outside out of my hands. And what's in my circle, what the causes I can tend to includes things like, am I tuning into peace in the first place? You know, it's a little bit like, I think of diving. I've done a lot of diving and swimming and stuff like that. You know, you watch these people who are diving, they're diving from a stable platform. Even if it's a board, it's a very stable, predictable board. It's not really erratic. And I think it's about finding our place and then engaging from there. So do we find peace? Also, do we exercise restraint and, you know, over what we say? Do we make the point we can make? You know, that's what I mean by tending to the causes we can tend to. Do we work hard? Do we show up? You know, nothing digs ditches like spadefuls of dirt. You know, are we doing that part? And the Buddha's language, are we ardent, heartfelt, resolute, diligent, and mindful? Those are causes we can tend to. That's all I mean. Yeah. So what do you think of this idea? Oh, great. Yeah. Or anything you want to say about this territory.
I was going to talk a little bit about the peace part of it. And
yeah.
Please stand up.
Can't hear you.
Oh, dear. We're going to have more people, I think.
Stand up, but I'll talk loud if you want me to.
Yeah.
Do that.
Okay, great.
So Linda helped me last week, actually. We were talking about the whole unwholesome and unwholesome thoughts and in relation to how does this practice work and how do you find that peace? And I thought it was something really mystical, because when you practice, it just happens. But what she explained, and you've talked about before too, is that it's about being mindful of the thoughts that you're having and which ones are wholesome and which ones are unwholesome, and cultivating the wholesome and not the unwholesome. And I'm finding more and more it becomes a natural state that it's kind of reverting back to how I was before life got so complicated, and instead of something that I'm clamoring to find, but it's just something that was there all along. So that's the piece that you're talking. It seems like that's what the piece is. It's just kind of reverting back, right? Kind of to a natural state.
Yeah, thank you. You know, if you think of the frame of Buddha Dharma is about things are constantly changing, and yet their nature doesn't change. And sometimes it's said that God is that which doesn't change, in a deep sense. And I think that part of what happens is we have an intuition that amidst all the changes, there is something that remains still. And we have a feeling for it, we have a sense of it. I think it's probably true. My own view is that it is true. My view is that the deep intuition of stillness is based on, in some ultimate sense, the reality of unconditionality, the reality of stillness. And that clearly was the Buddha's view. It's given a lot of postmodernists conniption fits, but his very strong statement repeatedly, again and again and again, was that there was a realm of conditionality which is based on causes and it's in time and its primary characteristic is impermanence. And yet there was, and he called it a sphere, a realm. He said it's beyond language. He referred to it as the deathless, where nothing changes there. There's a stillness there. He called it the island in the river of suffering. He referred to it as the unconditioned, unconditionality. So a lot of language about that. And I agree with the Buddha that we have that intuition because there really is some kind of reality that's outside the frame of ordinary reality that is still. It's unconditional. It's unconditioned. It's not subject to conditional processes. But that said, you don't have to believe that. I mean, you can see what you think about that for yourself. But minimally, dialing just this much in, you know, it's really clear that in our deep, deep experience, we have some sense of some awareness or some ongoing beingness that itself is not disturbed. Disturbances move through it, but it itself is not disturbed. And so let's think about some ways into it. One is relaxation, just relaxing. I'm not equating relaxation. I'm saying relaxation is like a beginning of a good path. Another is tranquility. That's really important. I remember Joseph Goldstein at a meditation retreat emphasizing the mental factor of tranquility, and not tranquility as numbing or suppression, you know, laying a concrete slab on top, ka-thunk, you know, the peace of the tomb, not that kind of peace that is the highest happiness, but rather a kind of growing tranquilizing and a sense of tranquility as like a mountain lake, still and peaceful. And again, it's worth asking, how much do we value tranquility in our dealings with other people? How much do we protect tranquility when other people, frankly, are doing what they can to agitate it? You know? So comments further? Marian? Could you speak up, Marian? I can't hear you.
I have found that when you go into a conflict situation,
yeah,
if you keep your expectations very low and use your voice as an instrument to convey a level of peacefulness and tranquility, it's quite remarkable. Both body language and the great gift, which is your speech, can be used in ways that I think most of us haven't practiced enough.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. You know, being peaceable, right, with other people. I read this little teaching of the Buddha recently where he talks about that we should be peaceable, friendly, and fearless. I just like that a lot. I can remember three words, you know, especially an easy one like friendly. But peaceable, friendly, and fearless. All right. Yeah, please.
I'm taking a class at Green Gulch, and the priest said that the Buddha says, stop quarreling. which sound, I mean, I thought that just sounded delightful. This idea of not quarreling. And most people I don't quarrel with, but there's always a you know, maybe a person where there's this kind of sticky relationship. So I'm thinking, how, when the situation gets that sort of tension or that stickiness, how do you break the that cycle and stop the quarreling? I like what Marianne said.
Marianne. Well, thanks for saying that. I'm reminded of one of the lines from the Buddha is, those who realize they will die abandon their quarrels. You know, and something about that. And there's a lot in there about stepping out of contentiousness. Now, it's interesting, too, a lot of the Pali Canon, you know, the first, earliest teachings, are, you could say, arguments between the Buddha and some other Brahmin person, because that was the structure a lot. You know, it's kind of like almost philosophical debate. But what you can see about the Buddha, at least as he's represented, is he makes his point clearly, and he says what he thinks, but he doesn't keep pounding on. He doesn't engage in a quarrel. He makes the offering, as it were, and then he's disentangled from it. So I think that, for me, is a piece of it. And the second thing, it goes to what he said, what you said, which is that I find, for me, the where I get in trouble is when I want something to happen inside the black box of the other person's mind, right? That's when I immediately get into trouble. And weirdly, I think there's this paradox, it's not really a paradox, but it's a seeming paradox, where we open out into feeling deeply intimate and related to other people, while simultaneously, in a sense, not trying to make something happen inside them. You know, we give compassion, we give loving kindness, but as soon as we start getting caught up in wanting to make something happen inside them, we're kind of in a yellow flag condition. I personally think there's a place for a little bit of persuasion, a little bit of exhortation. You look at the Buddha, he spent 40 years exhorting and teaching people and persuading them and doing what he could to motivate them. But to, you know, to not tip too far. And I know for myself, maybe this is where I'll leave it with you, the more I personally value peace, the less I get into hassles. And maybe because I'm getting old. Have you noticed that? We're getting older. Who knew? But anyway, it's like the more we value peace, the more we're just not moved to it. You know, we say our thing, there's a freedom in it, we do the best we can, and so what do you think for yourself about valuing peace, relaxation, tranquility, not contending, not quarreling, you know, the valuing of peace? That's kind of the question to leave you with. Yeah, just do a couple more and then we'll wrap up. Yeah.
I just had a question, actually. I try to practice this as much as I can, and as I get older, I think it's true. I do feel more tranquil and more peaceful. But I also notice that I'm tending to isolate from people. Mm. And I feel a little concerned about that. It's not out of any problem with other people, but just I'm so much enjoying my being alone. And I don't know if that's healthy. Maybe you have advice.
I don't know. I don't think I have a right answer. You know, I think there's some truth to it, to protect our own peace, you know? And you know, I like Thich Nhat Hanh, right? Great Vietnamese Buddhist teacher and peace activist. And what I observe about him, and I've had, you know, I've recently dealt with his office, and they protect him. They protect his mind stream. They protect his peace. And this is someone who's very engaged still in the world and so around social justice and so forth. But, you know, I think of the Buddha as, here's the way I would put it. You know, he emphasized this phrase again and again that is very practical for us. he when he described his own process of awakening, he describes various states. Greed, and he says greed basically arose. This was before he was completely enlightened, so he was like us, unless there's someone who's already, I'm not there. Okay. He said greed arose, but it did not invade my mind and remain. Hatred arose. Aversion, resistance, anger, ill will. Hatred arose, but it did not invade my mind and remain. Delusion arose, ignorance, but it did not invade my mind and remain. It couldn't root. And that's the thing. And I think that's the question. Do we construct our lives so that even if we're engaged in situations and maybe a certain contentiousness arises briefly at least, does it invade the mind and remain? Remain. Invade the mind and remain. You know, like Bermuda grass that infests your yard and you can't ever get it out. Been there. You know, it remains. So that's the trick. And so I think a lot, the trick is to be in life, but to be watching, does it invade my mind and remain? And to have the will to protect our own tranquility. You know? Now, I think it's also true that at the deepest levels of the psyche, let alone ultimate reality, nothing can invade and remain. You know? And that's a beautiful comfort. Deep down, nothing can invade the mind and remain. And the opportunity, I think, is increasingly to take our stance there. So, how about two more people? You and then Blythe, okay? Yeah. You, right there. I don't know everybody's name. I'm trying to, but anyway. Yeah.
And my feeling, in addition to everything that the Buddha has said, is that if I could stop being afraid to die, I would have more compassion for myself and for everyone else. Because this is the way it is.
Yeah. Thank you. That's right. Yeah. Thank you. Okay.
I can sort of piggyback onto that. I've been so disappointed with the global situation and our national situation and how so many people in leadership lack the character that we wish they had and the virtues that it seems like they should have as public servants. And I've grown to appreciate, it's helped me grow to appreciate all the amazing good people in the world and all the people who are just working hard to do their jobs. And so my practice at the end of each day now is to meditate and be grateful and really take in all the wonderful people who are total gifts in my day during that day. And it could be the guy at the gas station who I gave my money to or just people in passing. You know, I always have a quick chat with the bridge toll guy. And by taking that in, and having that kind of an equanimity around that and a, I don't know how to explain it, but just there's a oneness that I feel, that there is this network of good souls out there. When I come across the lemons, I cannot, it's more depersonalized for me, you know, and I can just, that'll pass and I don't need to engage as much. And I'm going through some really tough, I'm going through divorce and a stepmother who's taken the family estate and some really, really intense things. Mm. So each day of life is a gift, and it's those small interactions with wonderful people all over the place that gives me such joy.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. Well, we've got to wrap up, and I just, how can I put this? I suggest that inside your mind, and I'll do it with you, you simply murmur softly one or more times, and feel free to adapt what I'm suggesting here. May I be at peace. And see what that means to you and what sense you have of being at peace. May I be at peace. Can you have any sense, if only for a fraction of a second, of true peace? And can you imagine what it would be like to live your life engaged as you are from being at peace? It's like deep down somewhere, we are all already at peace. Minimally in our own psychology and nervous system, and in my view, ultimately, we all arise in some sense out of peace. You know, what would it be like to uncover again and again over your day the sense of being already at peace? And then using the metaphor of the jewel in the lotus, the diamond in the lotus of compassion and the diamond of wisdom. Sometimes it's given the other way. Mixed together, you know, how love gets joined with somehow in a deeply natural way with feeling already peaceful, already at peace. May all beings everywhere be truly at peace, including the beings in this room tonight. Thanks. Thank you. The highest happiness, right? Uh-huh. Peace.
See you next week.